From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
There is simply no peaceful rationale for the Iranian regime to resume uranium enrichment.
The crisis over Iran's nuclear program intensifies after Iran removes seals at three nuclear facilities following a two-year freeze. We'll take a look at the latest. Then on this last day of hearings for Samuel Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court, we'll look at a case that pitted Samuel Alito against Pacifica Radio. It was more than 20 years ago. And we'll go to New Orleans and look at the ongoing struggles around rebuilding the city after Hurricane Katrina. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Capitol Hill, Samuel Alito wrapped up his final day of testimony in a Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Senators began hearing from witnesses and testimony that will continue today. Senate aides predicted Alito will be approved by the Judiciary Committee on a 10-8 vote along party lines, perhaps as early as next week. We'll have more on Samuel Alito later in the program. This news on the Iran nuclear standoff. Thursday, Iran threatened to halt snap inspections of its nuclear sites by the United Nations if it's referred to the Security Council. The protocol allows intrusive and short-notice inspections of Iran's nuclear sites. The move came after the United States, Britain, France, and Germany said Thursday nuclear talks with Iran are at a dead end and the issue should be brought before the Council. The crisis over Iran's nuclear program intensified this week after Iran removed the seals at three nuclear facilities following a two-year freeze. Iran says its nuclear programs are solely for the peaceful generation of electricity. We'll have more on the story after headlines. In Saudi Arabia, Muslim pilgrims attending the annual Hajj set off a stampede that killed at least 345 people. Almost 300 more were injured. The deaths occurred during the final day of the ritual stoning of the devil in the Mena Desert, in which pilgrims throw stones at pillars to purge themselves of sin. The deaths come a week after the collapse of a pilgrim hotel that killed 76 people. Thursday's stampede caused the highest death toll since over 1,400 people died in a stampede in a Mecca tunnel in 1990. Over 240 were killed in another stampede in 2004. In this country, Jose Padilla pleaded not guilty to terrorism charges in a Miami court. A judge denied his request for bail. Padilla was only charged in November after over 3 years in solitary confinement on a military brig in South Carolina. At the time of his arrest in May 2002, then-Attorney General John Ashcroft accused Padilla of involvement in a terrorist plot to attack the United States by exploding a radioactive dirty bomb. None of his current charges include these allegations. Last month, a federal appeals court suggested the Bush administration only charge Padilla to thwart his pending Supreme Court appeal. His trial has been set for September. In Virginia, new DNA tests have confirmed the guilt of an executed murderer who went to his death proclaiming his innocence. Roger Keith Coleman was convicted for the 1981 rape and murder of his sister-in-law, Wanda McCoy, executed 11 years later. The DNA was ordered last month by Virginia Governor Mark Warner, the first time a governor has ordered testing on the remains of someone put to death. In Maryland, state legislators passed a law Thursday that would require retail giant Walmart to increase health care spending for its employees. The measure is expected to be replicated in other states. Its passage overrides a gubernatorial veto and follows an intense lobbying battle between Walmart and labor groups. Under the new law, employers with 100,000 or more workers must devote at least 8% of their payrolls to health insurance or pay the difference into a state Medicaid fund. A Walmart spokesperson told the New York Times the company is considering bringing a lawsuit to challenge the law. Democratic State Senator Gloria Lalwa, who sponsored the bill, said, quote, "This is not a Walmart bill. It's a Medicaid bill. This bill says to the conglomerates, don't dump the employees that you refuse to insure into our Medicaid systems," she said. This news from Germany. The German intelligence service is coming under heavy criticism amid revelations its agents lent support to the United States invasion of Iraq. According to several media reports, German Federal Intelligence Service agents in Baghdad helped select at least one bombing target aimed at Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, in which 12 civilians were killed. The operation was reportedly approved by the government of former Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, despite Germany's public opposition to the war at the time. In Haiti, residents of Cité Soleil held a massive demonstration Thursday in protest of a planned UN armed raid on their neighborhoods. UN mission head Juan Gabriel Valdez vowed a raid is imminent amid growing calls from Haiti's business leaders and foreign officials. Aid workers are already reporting one person has been killed and 17 injured in clashes with UN troops this week. The injured include a 12-year-old girl. John Joel Joseph, a community organizer for Lavalas, the political party of ousted Haiti President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, told the Associated Press, quote, "The population is standing up to say no to UN persecution in Cité Soleil. Every day we are counting dead bodies," he said. In the Philippines, a judge has issued an arrest warrant for four U.S. Marines accused in the rape of a 22-year-old Filipina woman near a former U.S. Navy base in November. The soldiers are currently detained at the U.S. Embassy. The U.S. government has not indicated whether the soldiers will be handed over. In Kenya, the World Food Program is warning over 2 million people are in need of food aid to overcome a drought that's caused two failed rainy seasons. The president of Kenya, Mwai Kibaki, recently declared food shortages in the arid north and some coastal areas a national disaster. This is the World Food Program's Peter Smerdon.
Food and money is needed now if we're going to tackle this problem and people will survive. If we do not receive donations, it's going to be very miserable and very difficult for a lot of people in Kenya and elsewhere, and there will be loss of life.
Peter Smerdon of the World Food Program. This news from Britain. The London Times is reporting powerful business groups are funding and even drafting the reports of supposedly independent British parliamentary groups investigating policies in which they have a commercial interest. Two-thirds of the nearly 300 such groups are now assisted by special interest groups, the newspaper said. And after nearly 25 years in prison, Mehmet Ali Agha, the man who shot Pope John Paul II, was released from prison Thursday. Agha shot the late John Paul in St. Peter's Square on May 13, 1981. The Pope survived the attack and forgave him in a visit to his prison cell 2 years later. He served 20 years in jail before being transferred to Turkey to serve the remaining years of a sentence in the 1978 killing of Abdi Epeki, the editor of a left-wing Turkish newspaper. Immediately after his release, Agha was taken into custody by the Turkish army after overfailing to complete mandatory military service. He'll be held as military officials review his case. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. Iran threatened to halt snap inspections of its nuclear sites by the United Nations if the crisis over Iran's nuclear program is referred to the Security Council. The protocol allows intrusive and short-notice inspections of the country's nuclear sites. The move came after the United States, Britain, France, and Germany said Thursday that nuclear talks with Iran were at a dead end and the issue should be brought before the Council. The crisis over Iran's nuclear program intensified this week after Iran removed seals at three nuclear facilities following a two-year freeze. The government of Iran says its nuclear programs are solely for the peaceful generation of electricity. This is the former president of Iran, Rafsanjani.
Now, the subject is very serious and sensitive and is the top issue.
دانش روز برخوردار نشن چند قدم عقب باشن اینا فکر میکنن.
It seems that they, the West, don't want an Islamic country to have new technology and want them to be backward.
هستیس یکی نانوی یکی آیتیه که ما هم تو مجمع تشخیص مصنوعات تصمیم گرفتیم.
But we are determined to have this technology.
ندیده بگیریم و به اونجا که باید برسیم برسیم.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice urged the UN Thursday to confront what she called Iran's defiance over its nuclear program.
We also agree that the removal of seals by the Iranian government in defiance of numerous IAEA board resolutions demonstrates that it has chosen confrontation with the international community over cooperation and negotiation. As the EU3 and EU have declared, these provocative actions by the Iranian regime have shattered the basis for negotiation. We join the European Union and many other members of the international community in condemning the Iranian government's deliberate escalation of this issue. There is simply no peaceful rationale for the Iranian regime to resume uranium enrichment. We are gravely concerned by Iran's long history of hiding sensitive nuclear activities from the IAEA in violation of its obligations, its refusal to cooperate with the IAEA's investigation, its rejection of diplomatic initiatives offered by the EU and Russia, and now its dangerous defiance of the entire international community.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, this is Massachusetts Senator John Kerry.
Ultimately, if we're not able to find a diplomatic resolution in the next weeks, I don't think we have any choice but to take it to the international community. I think Iran has made a very dangerous and a very silly decision. And it really is inviting confrontation, not with the United States, but with the global community that cares enormously about the control of nuclear weapons.
Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan stressed diplomatic talks with Iran were still on the table.
First of all, I think we should try and resolve it, if possible, in the IAEA context. And El Baradei is working with the parties, doing his best to try and resolve it there. Once that process is exhausted, it may end up in the Council, and I would leave it to the Council to decide what to do if it were to come here. I wouldn't want to preempt them. And my own, no, I've been talking to all the parties, doing whatever I can to encourage a negotiated settlement and really keeping people at the table and trying to avoid and discourage escalation. And I will continue to do that. My good offices are always available if I need to do more, and the parties so wish, I will do it.
That's Kofi Annan. For more on Iran, we are joined by Ervan Ebrahimian. He is a Middle East and Iran expert at Baruch College, City University of New York, author of several books, and co-author of Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. The professor joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, can you talk about the latest, what looks like is evolving as a major crisis at the United Nations?
Yes, I think what we're seeing are beginnings of escalation, which can eventually lead to some sort of military confrontation. Because of the Iraqi war, we have the sort of the premise that wars are done by design, by intention. The Iraqi war was actually very much of an exception. Most wars come out of miscalculation, misjudgment, playing chickens, expecting the other side to climb down. And this is a classic case where the two sides have irreconcilable interests, and the two sides are going to, in fact, play chicken, expecting the other side to back down. And as far as I can see, neither side is going to back down. So along the road, military confrontation is very much likely.
And your sense of the role of China and Russia in terms in the Security Council, if this does move now to the Security Council?
Well, Iran in the past has been hoping, with the help of also India and other countries. But the bottom line is, when it comes to who can offer what, of course, the U.S. can offer China and Russia far more than Iran can. So Iran is not really going to get much protection from those countries. And it probably knows that. It's willing to go along because it feels it has the other cards it can play against the United States. So Iran's actually acting from a position of strength the way they see it. And this makes it very dangerous because they are overconfident about the situation.
And the New York Times is reporting today that Israel, behind the scenes, is pressing very hard on this issue of Iran. But the the hypocrisy of many of these Western countries raising these issues about Iran's nuclear program while Israel's nuclear program goes basically unnoticed or untargeted, not targeted by any of the other major powers.
Yes, and it's not, of course, only Israel. There, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. As is often, Israel constantly says Israel lives in a dangerous neighborhood, but actually Iran lives in the same dangerous neighborhood. Although Iran is adamant that it has no intention of building the bomb, clearly what the policy is to have the capabilities of building the bomb if necessary. And this is directly related to Iran's experience during the Iraqi war, when the Iraqis were using weapons of mass destruction and the international community didn't lift a finger. In fact, countries like the United States helped Iraq use these weapons on Iran, actually sold the materials and looked the other way and denied the fact that Iraq had been using it. And from this experience, the Iranian decision makers have come to the conclusion that they need to be self-reliant. And if they're ever in a situation like that again, they would be able to build a bomb. But that doesn't mean they want to build a bomb now. In the nuclear business, it's known as the Japanese option. Japan has this option within a few months of building a bomb, because it has all the equipment, it has the science, it has the knowledge. And this Japanese option, actually, some 30 countries in the world has it. And I think the strategy of the Iranian leadership is to be in the same position.
Why do you think it pulled the seals now?
Well, I think this has been building up. I mean, Iran... kept on insisting this was a voluntary freeze while they're negotiating with the Europeans. And those negotiations really went nowhere, mainly because Europeans were doing it for proxy to the United States. The United States was not involved. And since they discovered that basically they were freezing it indefinitely, it was not in their interest, so this is for them a time to do it. And, of course, what they see is the U.S. Quadmire in Iraq. They feel that the United States really can't do anything at the moment, and this is a perfect situation to go ahead.
We're talking to Professor Ervand Abrahamian of Baruch College, who has co-written the book Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. In news, the Times of London reported that Israel's armed forces have been ordered by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, this was in December, to be ready by the end of March for possible strikes on secret uranium enrichment sites in Iran. Israel has denied the report.
Yes, it doesn't really matter whether it's a U.S. does the strike or Israel does it, because Iran would obviously retaliate, and it really can't retaliate against Israel, but it could easily retaliate against the United States. So if Israel carries out airstrikes, it'll be the United States that'll suffer for it, and the pain for the United States will come predominantly in Afghanistan and Iraq. In both countries, Iran, to use the jingo language, they have the assets, got a great deal of assets to cause a lot of trouble for the United States. And the last thing I think the U.S. military wants in Iraq is a Shia revolt while they're dealing with a Sunni revolt.
You've talked about, or I'd like to ask you about, the president of Iran's comments on Israel, saying the Holocaust is a myth, saying Israel should be wiped off the face of the map, perhaps it should be established in some place like Alaska. Your response?
Well, there are actually two explanations for this. One is this type of thinking is pretty current among right-wing in Iran. And the right-wing in Iran is no more sophisticated than the right-wing elsewhere. They pick up a few things from information about history, and they elaborate to a Holocaust denial. So every time in Europe someone questions a thing about the Holocaust, it's picked up in the right-wing newspapers in Iran as a major fact. So Ahmadinejad has very much, I think, comes from that perspective, the questions about the Holocaust. Then the question is, why is he being so adamant and insistent on it now? And I think that's a more interesting issue. If you look at it in the Middle East arena, in the Sunni Arab world, Iran is seen as a collaborator with United States. This may sound strange in United States, but from their perspective, what's happening in Iraq is the government that's set up in Baghdad is a Shia government, pro-Iranian, but it's also working together closely with United States. I think this is a marriage of convenience that's not going to last long, but from the Sunni, especially right-wing Sunni fundamentalist perspective, the Shias and the Iranians are actually in cahoots with United States. Now, to basically overcome this stigma, the president in Iran as being more anti-Israeli than the Arabs. So if he can come out with these statements, he could say, well, look, I'm actually more pro-Palestinian, I'm more pro-Muslim, I'm more pro-Arab, I'm more anti-Israeli than you are because I'm denying the Holocaust, I'm denying the legitimacy of Israel. And this is, again, from a right-wing Iranian perspective, the more moderates, liberals, reformers, had for a long time come to the conclusion that a two-state solution was the best thing. And the former president had actually gone on record as saying that anything the Palestinians accepted, Iran would have to accept too. So if the Palestinians wanted a two-state solution, recognize Israel, it's not really the task of Iran to sabotage that and say no. But I think here, what the Ahmadinejad is trying to do is like being more a Catholic than the Pope, being more anti-Israeli than the Palestinians and the Arabs as a way of forestalling the criticism that Iran is working with United States.
And in terms of North Korea, obviously the focus now, once again, on Iran and the nuclear program in Iran has basically forced North Korea out of the news. You hear virtually nothing about it anymore. And the United States policy of bringing this case to the UN while continuing to keep North Korea sort of aside in local regional talks there with some of the major powers there. Your perspective on the different approaches of the United States, of the Bush administration?
Yes, I mean, from the people in Tehran, their perspective is, look, North Korea has the bomb and the U.S. is negotiating with it. Saddam Hussein didn't have the bomb, and look what happened to him. So within, I think, Iranian elite, there is this debate. If once Iran gets to the point of having the capabilities, should Iran then go that stretch, one lap, and actually build the bomb? And these are sort of questions that would be raised. In fact, what is surprising is the last few years in Iran, there has been much open discussion whether one should have the nuclear capability and the bomb. And I don't know any other country that ever actually had such a debate. I mean, United States, when it built the bomb, or Germany, or France, or Russia, or China, they did it secretly, and it became a de facto thing. But in Iran, there's actually quite a sophisticated knowledge about the dangers of going that route. And there's much discussion about it, the pros and cons of it. And there are even military leaders who've argued that it's not in Iran's interest to build a bomb. They all agree on it's important to have the capabilities. But the actual to have the bomb is a debated issue. And many, of, I would say, important people would argue that it's not in Iran's interest to actually have the bomb.
We only have 30 seconds, but in your book you write the United States is on a collision course with Iran. The main casualty could well be the democratic movement in Iran. What did you mean?
Well, it's already occurred. I mean, the casualty has been the democratic movement because under the Khatami Clinton administrations, there was actually a rapprochement, the detente. The two were pretty on good terms. And then you had the neocons coming into Washington and the axis of evil speech that basically undercut the reformers in Iran, because reformers by basically inevitably were associated with good relations with the United States. And here you have someone in Washington calling for the destruction of the Islamic Republic, calling it axis of evil. That really a major reason for the undermining of the reformers. So that's already occurred 3 years ago.
Well, this is a conversation that we will continue. Professor Ervand Ebrahimian is Middle East and Iran expert at Baruch College at the City University of New York, co-author of Inventing the Axis of Evil, the truth about North Korea, Iran, and Syria. When we come back from break, we go south to New Orleans, reconstruction and disaster after Katrina. Stay with us. Music by Zarif from the album Anthology of World Music, Iran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on 400 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as on NPR, PBS, and public access TV stations, and on the two TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, and video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to New Orleans and the ongoing struggles around rebuilding the city after the Hurricane Katrina disaster. Earlier this week, Bring Back New Orleans, the city's rebuilding commission, unveiled the first of seven reports that are part of a sweeping redevelopment plan for the city. The committee's proposal was presented at a meeting on Wednesday with hundreds of residents in attendance. Most of the residents responded to the proposal with anger and frustration when they heard that it would give neighborhoods in low-lying parts of the city 4 months to a year to prove that they should not be bulldozed. Under the proposal, residents in the hardest-hit neighborhoods would not be permitted to move back for at least 4 months. During that time, leaders of each neighborhood would have to submit a recovery plan that would have to be approved before residents would be allowed back. Neighborhoods that are not able to come up with a plan or that do not attract enough development within a year would be bulldozed. The proposal was put together by the Commission's Urban Planning Committee, which is headed by the multimillionaire real estate developer Joseph Cannizzaro.
Also this week, a deal was reached to stall many evictions of evacuees staying in hotels throughout New Orleans. In the last few weeks, a number of hotels had notified evacuees they would soon be evicted to make way for tourists who would book rooms during the Mardi Gras celebration at the end of February. About 15,000 of the displaced are staying in hotel rooms in Louisiana, most of them located in New Orleans. We are joined right now by Marc Morial. He is president of the National Urban League. He was also the mayor of New Orleans from 1994 to 2002. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
President Bush was in New Orleans yesterday. You were in New Orleans this week. Can you talk about the situation there?
Well, I think the recovery is slow. It hasn't made the kind of progress that I think most people expected. While the areas of the city that were modestly hit or not affected at all by Katrina appear to be back to normal. Underneath, you have universities that are closed and schools that are closed and businesses that are closed, and that affects not only the areas that were dramatically affected, but the areas that were not affected. Secondly, I spent time last week in New Orleans on Friday before the New Orleans City Council with the other two former mayors who are living, Moon Landrieu and Sidney Bartholomew, along with a number of regional political leaders, emphasizing in a show of unity the need for the federal government to make a commitment to a first-class Category 5 flood protection and levee system. Then on Saturday, I went out to New Orleans East, one of the areas devastated, spoke to about 1,000 people at St. Maria Goretti Church, where people are having services and there is no electricity. There's no carpet or flooring. It's a concrete floor. But people's resolve. I say all of this to say that the plan that was proposed and released the day before yesterday is just awful. It doesn't do justice or respect to the idea that everyone ought to have an equal right to return. It's a plan that redlines neighborhoods, and behind it creates an all-powerful redevelopment authority that would use eminent domain to come in and basically gobble up two-thirds of the city for some sort of redevelopment initiative. This is not the kind of plan that commission should have proposed. It's not the type of plan that's designed to sort of bring together the kind of support the city needs, and I don't think it's the kind of plan that fundamentally respects the fact that many, many people have lost virtually everything. And their home, their equity in the home, their neighborhoods, their communities, their churches is all they've got. And this plan erects barriers between them and their return to the areas that they call home. So from my standpoint, from the standpoint of the National Urban League, and as a son of the city, we think any plan ought to be evaluated based on what we call the Katrina Bill of Rights. It's at our website at NUL.org. It talks about the right to rebuild and the right to return, and that everyone ought to have that right and ought to have a right to participate in the decision making. It seems as though the commission, according to what many people in New Orleans sense, seemed to be fundamentally the decisions were made by a small group of wealthy real estate oriented types, some of whom I have great respect for, but whose perspective is not broad and whose perspective is not inclusive. So this is an issue for the nation, because we now have a great American city, a great region, southern Louisiana, southern Mississippi, fighting for survival. And I believe that a great nation which has rebuilt Kosovo and in the process of spending a lot of money to rebuild Baghdad, rebuilt Europe after the war, and rebuilt Japan after that war, ought to have an unyielding and unequivocal commitment to do the absolute right thing to help its own citizens rebuild their lives, rebuild their neighborhoods, and rebuild their communities.
I'd like to ask you, in terms of the of how reconstruction is going in areas in like southern Mississippi as well. You know, the coast areas, there have been all kinds of questions about luxury homes being built on coastal areas and lowlands. That is the reconstruction there going differently than how what's happening in New Orleans?
I've not been to southern Mississippi in a bit. From what I understand, they have more progress there. The governor there and the leaders there have moved quickly. Now, they've got a different set of issues because, to a great extent, in southern Mississippi, the devastation was total. So they're dealing with complete communities that were flattened. So they have no alternative except to build buildings from scratch. In New Orleans, you have buildings that are still standing, but substantially destroyed.
Might it also have something to do with Louisiana is run by Democrats and Mississippi? Well, the governor's the former head, Haley Barbour, of the Republican National Committee, a major force in the Republican Party in terms of who gets funding.
Yeah. I don't have an opinion on that, quite frankly, but I do think that one thing that's clear from the recent supplemental appropriations bill is that Mississippi has benefited from the fact that Senator Thad Cochran is chair of the Senate Committee on Appropriations. And that fact alone puts him in a position to kind of have the final word on any supplemental and a powerful bargaining chip, not only with his colleagues, but on behalf of the people of Mississippi. Louisiana, on the other hand, at this point in time, doesn't have a similarly situated member of Congress.
We're talking to Marc Morial, who is president of the National Urban League and is the former mayor of New Orleans. We're also joined on the telephone from New Orleans by Tracy Washington. She is an attorney who focuses on civil rights law and has been doing a lot of legwork over the last weeks as she goes from hotel to hotel to try to prevent the evictions of evacuees for tourists coming in for Mardi Gras. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tracy Washington.
Thank you so much.
Can you talk about what's happening and how the court has responded?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about what's happening with the hotels, but I think it needs to be taken in light of the big picture in what's going on with the city, and I think Mayor Morial addressed a lot of that. What's going on with the hotels is that when FEMA made the decision to allow Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita evacuees to stay in hotels, what was not planned for adequately is what was going to happen when that hotel stay time was terminated. There is no binding contract between FEMA and the hotel operators to retain these evacuees for any given period. They are basically at will in the hotels, according to FEMA's agreement, if you want to call it that, with the hotel operators. Unfortunately, because FEMA has vacillated and changed its position so often concerning when it will stop supplements to these hotels, the evacuees have been stuck between a rock and a hard place, not knowing from week to week, every 2 weeks, from every 2 weeks, when they will be forced to leave. When on Saturday, we learned, last Saturday, we learned that several evacuees were being evicted from a hotel on St. Charles Avenue, namely because in some instances the hotel didn't know whether the evacuees' rooms were still going to be paid for, and also because the hotel sits right on the on St. Charles Avenue where the parade routes go, and therefore had been booking rooms for carnival tourists. Those evacuees were turned out. They were standing on St. Charles Avenue, in many cases with garbage bags filled with their things, while the hotel operator was throwing out mattresses, furniture, and things of that nature. What I did, along with Bill Quigley, professor at Loyola University School of Law, is go to court on Saturday, find a judge, and seek a restraining order against the hotel from evicting these evacuees. Our position at that time was that, and is that, these individuals have been living in these hotels in many instances since October and have been treating these hotels just as they would any apartment complex. They were tenants. The hotels have served as landlords, highly compensated landlords. And because there's no self-help eviction in Louisiana and in Orleans Parish, these hotel operators should have been forced to go to court and give some due process to these residents prior to simply turning them out onto the streets.
And about how many people are still in hotels who were who were dislocated as a result of the hurricane?
It's my understanding from FEMA's numbers there are approximately 26,000 rooms that FEMA is paying for nationwide, somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000 to 10,000 in Louisiana. There is one hotel chain and operator, Decatur Hotels, which we've worked with, that has been housing upwards of 1,800 rooms of evacuees. Fortunately, we were able to work an agreement with that hotel chain, which owns about 22 hotels. And the hotel operators were gravely concerned about notice from FEMA and having a date certain when the supplements from FEMA to these hotels was going to end. You know, we can put the bad guy hat on the hotels in many instances, but in most cases, when you look big picture again, it's FEMA that's dropped the ball because it has changed course so many times. And I hate to say our state and local government here and its failure to plan adequately concerning where trailers are going to be placed in the city of New Orleans. If indeed FEMA has 30,000 trailers ready to be placed in New Orleans, the back and forth bickering amongst politicians here concerning where those trailers will be placed in Orleans Parish is absolutely absurd. These folks need to have a place to stay. Our mayor invited, begged, pleaded with evacuees all over the country to return home, to rebuild. And when folks get home, they can't rebuild in their neighborhoods. That's part of our bulldozing lawsuits because the mayor had made the decision without notice to bulldoze their properties in some areas of town, Lower Ninth Ward. And then there are no apartments and no trailers where they can reside after the supplements have ended.
I wanted to just play a clip for a moment of an Alabama Congress member, Arthur Davis, who was here in New York on Sunday talking about the aftermath of Katrina at the Reverend Jesse Jackson Wall Street Project event that was held, raising the issue of, well, the right of New Orleans residents who are not in New Orleans right now to vote. Let's take a listen and watch.
It is impossible to have a conversation about New Orleans' future, about Louisiana's future, in my opinion, without making sure that political participation is ensured on part of people who've been displaced. That's why we've introduced a bill that would give displaced voters from Louisiana the same absentee ballot voter protection that our soldiers have right now. Right now, if you're a soldier and you're in Germany, or you're in Japan, or you're in Afghanistan, or Iraq, you're allowed to vote absentee. Therefore, your political right back home is preserved. We have to do no less for the evacuees because of this reality. I remember before we left the press conference upstairs, there were a number of people who were there who were displaced citizens, and all of us hear the frustration every time we talk to them. Reverend Jackson, the main frustration I hear is no one is factoring our voices into the equation. All these people are sitting on the high side of the mountain talking about, do we rebuild? Should we rebuild? What do we rebuild? They're not asking the folk who live there. They're the one set of people excluded from the conversation. So that's the first step. We need to pass a bill giving that right to vote absentee ballot at the federal and state level to people who've been displaced.
That is Congressmember from Alabama, Arthur Davis. Mark Muriel, President National Urban League and former mayor of New Orleans, your response.
Congressman Davis is right. He's been on this issue from the very beginning. He's been a great ally and a powerful advocate of protecting voting rights and the right to vote being one of the Katrina Bill of Rights and one of the rights embodied in the Katrina Bill of Rights of the National Urban League released in October in a presentation I made at Georgetown University. A great nation, once again, which can ensure that Americans living abroad, soldiers living abroad, can in fact vote in presidential elections, can certainly ensure that New Orleanians and Louisianians and Mississippians that are living 200, 200, 300 miles away can vote in both local, and that's important because there are local elections upcoming this spring, state and federal elections. And I think the elections officials in Louisiana, the Justice Department, have to weigh in to ensure this, or this is going to be a black eye on the United States of America. People, while they may be living now in Houston, Dallas, or Atlanta, they're citizens of New Orleans. They are not living there voluntarily. They're living there involuntarily because of a situation which has occurred. And I really think Tracy Washington and Bill Quigley deserve a great deal of credit for protecting, working to protect the rights. One thing I would agree with Tracy on, when you look at the situation on housing with hotels and trailers, here is a classic case of there not being a coherent transition plan by FEMA and others to ensure that people have a way to transition from one type of housing, a shelter, maybe a hotel, to a trailer or a temporary place to locate. It's got to be adequate, careful planning to ensure that people's rights are protected.
What about the role of the mayor of New Orleans and the governor of Louisiana in terms of their using the weight of their offices around these issues? You were critical of the redevelopment plan, but the mayor obviously had a major role in
that commission. And I've tried to not make my comments oriented towards this politician or that politician, this leader or that leader, because I don't want anyone to interpret my thinking or our views as being political. Having said that, clearly, it's a joint responsibility of local leaders, state leaders, and federal leaders to do what is necessary to get this right. And all of us in the civil rights community, other members of Congress, we are going to hold officials accountable on behalf of the people. Because as I visited New Orleans, many, many people want us to play that role. They want to know that people on a national level, and what you're doing here on Democracy Now! By continuing to keep a spotlight on this is very, very important. And here's really sort of the baseline point for me. 9/11 was a great tragedy. Occurred in New York City. The response by the nation was swift, rapid, and unequivocal in terms of money, in terms of resources, in terms of organization. That's got to be the standard by which the Katrina response is measured. And in our Katrina Bill of Rights, we lay that out. That's the standard. This ought to be no less. It ought to not be different because it's Louisiana, because it's Mississippi, because it's the South, because the ethnic characters of the communities may be a little bit different, because they may be poorer. That's the standard by which this ought to be judged.
Although, as a resident of New York, I would warn you against using that New York standard, because 4 years later, we still have a hole in the ground right where Ground
That's
Zero
true.
Is.
That's true. You haven't rebuilt.
There has been no rebuilding after 4 years of the major, of the epicenter
That's
of
true.
The attack.
That is true.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much
for
being with us. Mark Morial, president of the National
Good
Urban
luck.
League, former mayor of New Orleans, and Tracy Washington will continue to talk to you about your work on the ground there in New Orleans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. We'll be right back. Here to Stay by the Rebirth Jazz Band from New Orleans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk now about the nomination of Supreme Court, nomination for Supreme Court Justice of Samuel Alito.
We'll hear arguments next in Federal Communications Commission against the League of Women Voters. Mr. Alito, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Those were the words of Chief Justice Warren Burger in January 1984 as he opened a Supreme Court case that pitted, yes, Samuel Alito against Pacifica Radio.
At the time, Alito was working as an assistant to Solicitor General Rex Lee in the Reagan Justice Department. The case centered on the constitutionality of a law that prohibited the airing of editorials by any public radio and TV outlet that received funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The law was challenged by Pacifica as well as the League of Women Voters of California and Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman. The case was known as the FCC versus the League of Women Voters. Samuel Alito argued before the court in favor of the ban on editorials in what the Los Angeles Times described at the time as, quote, one of the most important First Amendment cases of the current Supreme Court term. In a minute, we will hear a part of Alito's argument, but first we'll take a listen to attorney Frederick Wooker arguing against the law.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, at issue in this case is a statute that very straightforwardly and unabashedly suppresses speech of the highest order in our constitutional framework. If this statute were directed at the Washington Post, or presumably even at CBS TV, instead of at Pacifica Foundation, there would be no doubt of its unconstitutionality. Indeed, in Mills versus Alabama, this court said with respect to a similar ban on editorials that it was difficult to conceive of a more obvious and flagrant violation of the First Amendment. Yet here, the government is saying that the same ban on editorializing can't constitutionally be applied against Pacifica and other non-commercial broadcasters.
That was attorney Frederick Wooker arguing before the Supreme Court in 1984 in the case FCC versus League of Women Voters. At the time, Frederick Wooker was working for the Center for Law and the Public Interest. Earlier in the proceedings, then Assistant Solicitor General Samuel Alito argued in favor of the ban on editorializing by public radio and TV stations that receive government funding. This is an excerpt of Alito's argument before the Supreme Court. We begin with Justice John Paul Stevens questioning Alito.
I think your basic argument would really apply not merely to public television, but to all licensed television, wouldn't it?
No, not at all, Justice Stevens. Nothing in our submission has any implications for commercial broadcasting. The heart of our argument is that public broadcasting is very different in many ways from commercial broadcasting. It was created for a different purpose, and it is dominated by government entanglements that have no parallel whatsoever in the world of commercial broadcasting. And it is that which supports the constitutionality.
Well, there is this parallel, that in both areas, the government has the power to say you cannot continue to broadcast. I mean, because even in the private sector, they have the licensing power.
Well, that's certainly true, and government has considerable power over all broadcasting that it doesn't possess with respect to the print media. I think this court's cases have recognized that the government's power with respect to all broadcasting permits restrictions on the right to editorialize. The right to editorialize is also the right not to editorialize, as the court said in Miami Herald Company versus Tornillo, but commercial broadcasters are encouraged to editorialize and they have to give up time for reply under certain circumstances when they make an attack on an individual or a group or they support or oppose a candidate. That is a restriction on editorializing that would not be tolerated in the print media. The question here is whether the further restriction on editorializing that Section 399 puts into effect is justified by the special characteristics of public broadcasting.
That was then Assistant Solicitor General Samuel Alito arguing before the Supreme Court on January 16, 1984. Alito was defending a law prohibiting the broadcast of editorials by public radio and TV broadcasters that receive federal funding. 6 months later, the Supreme Court declared the editorial ban unconstitutional because it violated the First Amendment free speech guarantees. A series of outside groups also weighed in on the issue. The National Association of Broadcasters, CBS, and the American Civil Liberties Union all backed Pacifica, while the oil giant Mobil defended the ban on editorials.
In the majority opinion, Justice William Brennan wrote that the ban strikes, quote, at the heart of the First Amendment because it, quote, directly prohibits the broadcaster from speaking out on public issues even in a balanced and fair manner. Brenner was joined in the majority by Thurgood Marshall, Henry Blackman, Lewis Powell, and Sandra Day O'Connor. To discuss this, we're now joined by Frederick Wucher, the attorney who successfully argued the case against Samuel Alito. He joins us on the phone from Santa Monica, California, where he's an attorney in private practice. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Could you talk to us a little bit about how Samuel Alito got involved in the case?
Yes, it is a little interesting because he was not the attorney who was originally assigned to the case at the Solicitor General's office. That office handled the appeal after the district court had struck the statute down as unconstitutional. It went directly to the Supreme Court, and a more senior official in that office, a former Harvard Law professor, had actually been handling the case and wrote the briefs in the case and was shepherding the case through to oral argument. But the weekend before oral argument, he had a death in his family, I believe, and he was called away back to Massachusetts. And I received word on Friday that the following Monday, when the argument was scheduled, this new gentleman, Samuel Alito, would be actually handling the argument.
And so you made the argument, you won the case. Talk about the core, the heart of this issue.
Well, it's interesting. There were two issues, two grounds on which the government attempted to defend the statute. The first was that simply as a matter of First Amendment law, as you heard from the clip, because there was a concern that the unique nature of public broadcasting stations and their entanglement with the government and their dependence in many respects on government support, there was a fear that they could become propaganda organs for the federal government. And as a result of that fear, it was appropriate for them to prohibit the stations from editorializing. That argument had two flaws in it. One was it was really not supported by the legislative history, which suggested that, in fact, this had been inserted into the law by several Congress people who feared that the station could editorialize against them when and the actions they took in Congress. And the second problem was, frankly, that one of the plaintiffs in the case was Pacifica Foundation, and it just didn't really pass the straight face test that an organization like that would realistically present the fear of becoming a government propaganda organ. So actually, about 6 months before the case was heard in the Supreme Court, the statute was amended to tie the restriction on editorializing to the actual receipt of federal funds, because prior to that, it actually applied to stations whether or not they had received any government funds. And in that context, the government then said, well, you know what, this is our money that we're spending, and if we believe that we want to put restrictions on the way that money is used, we're perfectly entitled to do that, and the First Amendment really doesn't come into play because this is just a question of the government's spending power. And the flaw with that argument was, as the court ultimately ruled, that the restriction was, while it did apply to any station that received government funding, it applied to the use of any of their funds, so that even if a station like Pacifica was prepared to do, was willing to say, we will use only our private funds to editorialize, the law still restricted them from engaging in that activity. And as you heard, the court ruled on a 6-3 vote that was unconstitutional in violation of the First Amendment.
Frederick Wucher, I want to thank you for being with us. In the interest of disclosure, of course, Democracy Now! Started at Pacifica and airs on Pacifica radio stations around the country. Frederick Wucher argued the case before the Supreme Court. And by the way, happy birthday to you, and happy birthday in advance to Uri Galed, our director. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.